Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, September 11th, 2000. In the fireside room this morning is Trudy James. The session number is 2000-1, and the title is Caring for One Another at Times of Death. Let's listen in.
The reason I'm teaching this course is because I'm a lay person who does pastoral care, and I teach other lay people to do pastoral care. And I'm a hospital chaplain as well. And I believe that lay people are all called to do pastoral care. So how many of you think you do pastoral care already? Good. Good. Most of you think that you do. I think probably all people do it to some extent, but we don't claim it. Because pastoral care, traditionally and formally, we've thought of as what the pastor does. But when I started, my work has been with AIDS for the last 11 years, training teams of lay people from congregations and matching them with individuals and families living with AIDS to give them pastoral care. So I did that work in Arkansas when they were just pioneering care teams with AIDS, starting in 1989. And we grew from the very first little experimental care team to a network of 125 teams all over the state of Arkansas. And that's how I know that lay people can do pastoral care around difficult subjects, because that many people in Arkansas were doing it with AIDS patients. And now I work in Seattle. We have 27 teams caring for 32 men, women, and children with AIDS in Seattle. And the people come from every denomination, and there are people who come out of their theology, and that's why I put the word theology on there, because they come because for years they've sat in the pew and wanted to do what Jesus did, or they've taken the Holy Communion or the Lord's Supper or the Eucharist or whatever they called it, and thought of themselves as being the body of Christ, and thought that they should go into the world and be the body of Christ, but many of them haven't felt empowered to claim themselves as doing pastoral care. In fact, in AIDS work in the beginning, there just weren't very many pastors who were willing even to get involved with people with AIDS. It was such a difficult subject and associated with such difficult subjects that when I called them, they'd say, well, if you want to come and make an announcement, that's okay, but I can't talk about it because I have people in my congregation that would probably leave if I talked about AIDS, and I can't afford to get involved with AIDS. Now, there were some wonderful pastors who were up front also, and many who changed their minds. And in my sessions here, I've had, so far, two brave pastors who both have said, we really want our lay people to do pastoral care. We cannot begin to keep up with all the needs for pastoral care. But we don't know where to start. And so out of doing it with AIDS, I've grown into consulting for churches that want to get started with lay people doing pastoral care in a more specific way. So there's formal pastoral care that the pastor does. And a lot of that has to do with the sacraments and being sure that people have a way to be in touch with the sacraments. But the pastor in today's world cannot be there for all the people that are in grief and all the people that are dying. And really, I was in a church just a few weeks ago speaking, and they did the prayer concerns, and 17 different people prayed, raised their hands and prayed for family members with cancer in a church of less than 200 members. The needs are different now. Plus, some of you probably still go to small churches. Do any of you go to a small church where everyone knows everyone? Yeah. That's nice. You know, there are some of those left and where everyone knows. When I go to visit my mother, who goes to a small Lutheran church in the middle of Kansas, she can tell me the health status of everyone in her congregation and what their needs are pretty much on a regular basis. that doesn't happen most places. There's too much movement, and especially here in the Pacific Northwest, the churches I visit, most of the people have relocated from someplace else. And they don't have the family support, and they don't have the knowledge of the other people in their congregation. So lay people can do this in a very intentional way. I had some people here from a Lutheran church in Spokane who call themselves Offerings of the Heart, and they have a highly developed pastoral care program, ranging from greeting cards and meals at the time of a death to visits in the hospitals and the nursing homes, and they have well over 50 people involved in visiting, and they've trained them. That's rare, but people can be involved in that kind of formal pastoral care program. But what I want to tell you is that everyone can do pastoral care for someone in your family, in your church, or in your community. And that's what we're going to talk about, is how you can do that and how you can claim yourself as doing pastoral care. So a working definition might be that pastoral care is being present to people in some way, being present and consciously thinking of yourself as doing the work of God in some way. So you're there and you identify yourself as being present to people. I see a lot of pastoral care going on here at Holden. People just don't identify it to themselves in that way. And the reason for that is that we live in this expert mentality that we all grow up believing more and more, I think today, that experts have all the answers, and in this case it would be the pastor. And the pastor just can't have all the answers and all the time for everyone that needs someone with them. So this is my favorite quote. I've been using it to start the classes. It comes from this book that you all have a bibliography on the back of your outline, and this is probably my pick of the books in the bibliography, and it's in the bookstore. It's written by a woman physician who was extremely advanced in the medical profession, was the head of pediatrics at Stanford Hospital, and gradually came to see that she was called to do what she felt was more healing work, that expertise was curing people, but what was healing them was pastoral care. She doesn't define it exactly the same, but this is what she says. People have been healing each other since the beginning, long before there were surgeons, psychologists, oncologists, internists. People were there for each other. The healing of our present afflictions and woundedness may lie in recognizing and reclaiming the capacity we all have to heal each other. The enormous power in the simplest of human relationships, the strength of a touch, the blessing of forgiveness, the grace of someone else listening to you, someone else taking you just as you are and finding in you a goodness you didn't expect. So that's what we're talking about, is what we can do as pastoral caregivers, every one of us. And I want to say just a couple words about what calls people into this. However you might identify yourself, we're all called into this. This is what I saw with AIDS work. People came onto these teams for a variety of different reasons, but they kind of boiled down to people were grateful for what God had done in their own lives and they wanted to share that. Or people realized the help they had gotten getting through their own troubles and their own wounds, and that had called them into it. They felt some sense that they were called to do it. And I think everyone at some time feels moved to do some kind of service. And that's a calling. I regard those as callings. I grew up in the years when women couldn't be called, and for many years of my life, call was reserved for ordained ministry. But now, I think we're claiming the Lutheran teaching, the priesthood of all believers, and saying that everyone is called. Everyone is called. And it took me many years to figure out, because I knew I was supposed to do something, but, you know, I was in denominations where they didn't ordain women, so how could I be called? I did the next best thing for a while. I married a minister, and that was as close as I could get to called. And it finally, through my own journey and some of my own healing of events in my own life, in my case, the death of my first child and the suicide of my father, and then finally realizing that I had to grieve those losses many years later and other people could help me heal, led me to hospital chaplaincy for one thing, and then to see that people with AIDS needed this kind of healing from people, and that lay people could do it, and for many years I've seen them do it and get the rewards of doing it. So I like to share with people that they can do this work and they can get the rewards that come from doing pastoral care. The main, let me see. I want to say something about that expert mentality, because it's really what stops people is that they think they have to know a lot of answers. The kind of simple caring that we're talking about that is so needed doesn't require you to know a whole lot. It just requires you to be willing, to be present to people. And that's what I see happening here. Some people come here in a lot of pain, and other people just sit and be present to them, and it changes things, and they leave here changed. I've heard people talking about what's happened to them here. One woman said to me, "I've cried more here than I've cried since my husband died 5 years ago, and I feel so much better." It's because there were people around to be supportive. But we think we have to be experts to do it, and that stops us. And so today we're going to talk about death and dying, because that's an area where everyone needs some support in talking about it. We live in a culture that doesn't allow much talking about it. And with AIDS in the early days, there was no hope of a cure. So everyone was dealing with, we call them care partners, a care partner with AIDS who was going to die. And they were lay people who often were very uncomfortable with the whole idea of being with someone who was dying. And I'll tell you one story of how it works. A woman came to me at a training and said, I'm only here because I'm terrified at the whole idea of AIDS, and I came to learn what it was all about. Well, at the end of the training, she said, "Well, I've decided I want to be on the team, but I don't want to meet a person with AIDS because I don't like sickness and suffering. I don't even visit my own family when they're in the hospital. So I want to be on the team, though, and be part of my parish care team." And I said, "Well, what could you do that you'd be comfortable doing?" And she said, "Well, I can cook." And so we worked it out that she would cook and other people on the team would deliver the food to the AIDS patient. And she was doing caring through her cooking. But after 6 months of cooking and having a meal delivered once a week, there came a day when no one could deliver her food. And she had it ready, and so she decided, well, she'd have to take it herself. And she delivered it to the AIDS patient, and they had a conversation, and she decided maybe she could deliver the food from then on. So she began a relationship with the person with AIDS, and she grew to like him. And when he got sick and went in the hospital, she decided she would have to visit him in the hospital. And she began to visit him, and as he got sicker, they became very close, and when he died, she was the person in the room with him. He had no family, and she came to me and said, "I want to be the team leader for the next one." People start out doing what they're comfortable doing, but what they're comfortable doing changes. And when you reach out to other people, you get benefits from that. We call that mutuality of caring, because so many people have felt I remember visiting a team in Russellville, Arkansas. You know where that is. We have Arkansas people here today. So, and asking them what they had received from their ministry, and a young woman, college professor in Russellville from a Lutheran church, said, "Well, I've always been terrified of death. In fact, it's had a debilitating effect on my whole life. I've been so afraid of death that I've avoided doing many things because of my fears." And she said, being with these two young men as they face their death and getting to know them and seeing their courage has taken away my fear of death, and my life has changed for the better. And I've seen this particularly with death and dying around AIDS, that the more comfort we can all get in that area, the better our lives will be. And so I'm going to ask you first to do this little exercise that we have all of our care teams do when their patient becomes more ill, and we're talking about dying. So if you'd pass those pens around, and you're going to use your little card that you have, and no one else is going to see what you write. And this is this, because people cannot help others who need to talk about dying, and we all need to talk about dying until they become comfortable talking about their own death. And I found that many people on the teams had never talked about their own death or even thought about their own death. And therefore, I had a woman, a Methodist woman, say to me, "Every time our care partner starts talking about dying, I go into my cheerleader mode and say, 'No, you're not going to die. You have us for friends now. Don't worry about dying.'" That's sort of our normal reaction if someone brings up their own death. We want to say, "It's going to be okay. You're not going to die." Well, you know, many people are going to die. So, in fact, I think probably 100%. What do you think? You caught me. every one of us. So what I want you to write on this card is, I want you to write these words: "When I die, I..." And then I want you to finish the sentence.
"When I die, I..."
Mm-hmm. And go on with the sentence. So it'll be different for everyone, but whatever comes to your mind, "When I die, I..." Okay, I think we'll go on a little bit here. One of the things that that makes it hard to, when I started being a hospital chaplain, it felt so intrusive to talk to people about dying because you didn't know what to say. And I was afraid of saying the wrong thing and of doing the wrong thing. And the doctors, of course, never want to talk to patients about dying, so they often ask the hospital chaplain to see if you can get the patient to talk about dying, because they don't want to talk about it. They see it as failure. So I found if I would say to someone, "Well, the doctor says things don't look so good," they would either tell me everything or they would change the subject. I tell you that because I don't think you can hurt people by allowing the subject to come up. If they don't want it to come up, they won't let it come up. But what I want you to see from this exercise is why you don't have to know what to say, because everyone thinks about it somewhat differently. So I'm going to ask you, we're just about the size of a team here, and this is what I asked them to do. I'm just going to ask you to read these out loud to each other. And I want you to listen to each other and listen for the variety that you'll hear, because people see this differently. Vicki, would you start?
"Well, I have two categories, if it's a prolonged death or if it's a..." "When I die, I want to be with my family." This is if it were an extended illness or something. "And I want to be able to share freely what I'm feeling in the process as I die. But in case it's not a prolonged death, it's a fast one, I want my family to know ahead of time how I face or look at death." and to say the things I want to say right along as I'm living, so that they know if it's a sudden death that I've anticipated that, and I want them to be okay with it. And then I want to have my funeral planned, which I've done. I just haven't written it down yet. I need to do that. And what I want to leave in people's minds about my faith and my hopes for those who live after I die. And I want them to party.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Mark, how about you?
Okay, yeah. When I die, I know I will be the sixth person of nine of us that have already passed on. The only ones that will be left will be my two sisters and one brother left. Also, my death will mean my adopted parents will be this one still alive. I've been told that I might die anywhere from 1 to 3 years from now. And I have an adopted mother and an older sister who already know this, and I have already set two services into place. Last 5 years, six of the people in my family have already died. 2 years ago, three people died in a two-month period. And 3 years ago, three of my relatives have passed on in 2 weeks. So I've already set into motion my services is already written down, and I'm prepared for that already.
So you've made a plan?
I have the services already written
down. When you die, you'll have your plans in place.
I already have my plans in place.
Thank you.
Yeah.
When I die, I trust that my family will be around me and that I will be at peace with them, everyone else, and with God. I trust I will just be able to rest back on God's promises and Christ's loving arms. I hope I can live to old age, but not to disabling conditions, and can die without the burden of extensive illness, but above all, to be able to accept whatever comes.
I want you to hear the difference in the way people think about dying. There's similarities and there's a lot of differences because we each have our own way of making, it's a mystery for everyone, so we each have our own way of making some connection with it. What I always write on that card when I do it in a group is, when I die, in some mysterious way, I'll be reunited with all the people I've loved and lost. Some people think to the other side. Some people think about what's happening here as they die. Would you read yours next?
I didn't think so much about the process, but what I leave.
This is whatever comes to you, yeah.
When I die, I want to leave memories of a caring person, one who loves. Money, inheritance, is superfluous, and I wish to feel that I've been faithful to my calling.
That's wonderful. Thank you. Every one of these is special in its own way.
When I die, I will want family near. I want to be aware. I'm sorry.
It's okay. That's fine. We'll just go to Mel.
When I die, I hope that my family will carry on with good memories of me, and I hope that I leave no serious problems because of my lack of planning prior to my death. And I see I've written here because of my lack of planning my affairs prior to my death. I don't know. That's what it sounds like.
That sounds exactly like you think you did. You'd like to get your affairs in order. That's right. I hear your intention.
When I die, I hope my passing will be abrupt. I will be cremated. I hope my life will be remembered with a joyful wake.
Wonderful. You know, one reason I like to do this is that I've seen that when people frame pretty much in their mind the way they want to die, they often die that way. Mm-hmm. I had a man who died at 35, and a year before he died, we were making a video, and they interviewed him. And on the video, he said, I'm only 34 years old and I don't want to die, but if I die, I want the people I love, my family and my care team, to be around my bed when I die. And we didn't look at that video until after he was gone. He died in intensive care with his family and his care team praying around his bed. I've had other people that say, I want to die. I don't want this long suffering. I want to die a sudden death and having a heart attack. You know, I'm not saying it always works, but I'm saying it can't hurt to visualize that, just what you said. I'd rather it be this way.
I'm a physician, so I've seen a lot of people die in. I've seen a lot of what I thought of as good deaths and what
exactly there are good deaths and not so good deaths.
And yeah. And so I think I sort of just made a list of things I wanted and didn't want. I think I would hope to be at home and not in the hospital. I would hope to have my family and friends around. I'd want to be as comfortable as possible. I'd want to have music, and I want to have prayer and receive the sacraments.
That's a lovely picture, and it's so good to put that kind of picture out there and tell it to other people as well. Because if no one else knows that, you know, they might not think to bring the music. But I've been at deaths like that, where there was music in the room and there were people in the room who knew what the person wanted. And that's been one of the blessings of AIDS, is that it's been a long, slow process for some people, so they've had a lot of time. But I want to tell you, unless they have someone who cares about them and to talk to, they don't do this kind of talking. And so they're deprived of that. And many people in nursing homes would like to talk about their passing, and there's no one to talk to about it. It's one of the ways that lay people can be most helpful doing pastoral care, I think, is to allow people to say what they want and hope for. And words are very powerful. Saying what we want is very powerful. So, and we all see it differently. So you don't have to worry about having to tell someone about death. They have their feelings about death. They just usually don't get a chance to put them out. So I think death is one of the most important roles of lay pastoral caregivers. It's something we can do with our families, talking to our children, as you mentioned, or talking to our brothers and sisters about it, which you obviously have done because you were forced by circumstances to do it. But we can do it ahead of time.
Yeah.
The other aspect of death that I want to talk about this morning in relation to the most important pastoral care tool, which is listening, and becoming confident that our listening presence without knowing what to say is valuable. And it's hard for us to learn that because we're so used to talking and we're so used to giving advice and fixing things, and we're very much used to the social work mode of when someone verbalizes something as a problem that we should give them an answer rather than just listening. So in every one of these sessions, we're doing a listening exercise. And this one's going to be related to death and dying, and I'll tell you how in a minute. I want to tell you a couple more stories about the difference that lay people can make. This is one I just experienced recently, where I went to visit a man to see. His social worker referred him to me that he needed some friendship support. He was living all alone and his health was deteriorating. And when I went to do the interview, he told me no one had been to see him for 6 months except his social worker and his mother, who lived in a small town far away. No one. And so when I told him a group of people from a church would like to visit him and be his friends and maybe have some potluck dinners at his house and things like that, he was just amazed and happy and willing to try it, a little frightened, because when you talk to people about AIDS, about people from churches, it's a little scary because in their mind are the churches that said you're being punished by God. So we have to kind of try and erase that and build their confidence. But anyway, I had a team, a new team, and this particular team is the only one I've ever had like this, but it was all gay men from one church, from a large church in Seattle. And all of them mature people who had lost friends and had a fair amount of experience with AIDS. I think a couple of them, I'd only known one person with AIDS, but they're from a Baptist church and they wanted to do it. And so they got all organized for their first potluck and he went in the hospital. And he was in the hospital for the next 2.5 months and then he died. So they only got to know him in the hospital when he was dying. And because of them, he got out all his scrapbooks and told them all about his life. His mother came to visit him, got acquainted with them. They took her back and forth to the hospital on a regular basis. And when he died, his mother at the funeral service said, "These are all my sons." It was quite a beautiful thing. But the thing about it that impressed me was that I got a letter from the doctor and the social worker, and usually they don't acknowledge this kind of, they don't have time for one thing, but they said, "This man was one of our favorite patients, and it always bothered us that he felt his life had been wasted, and he often said he didn't have anything to leave to people, and he felt that he hadn't done anything with his life." And they said, "We saw such a change in him as he was dying because of the support of this team that they made him feel that his life had mattered and that he mattered." I think when people are dying, they're open to looking at their life, and we have a chance to help them see the meaning in it. And it's a spiritual process, dying. The way some of you verbalized it was very, very spiritual. The other thing I want to say is a lot of spiritual, what we might call, what the culture might call kind of woo-woo experiences happen to people around the time of death. Very meaningful, moving things happen around the time of death, and we don't talk about them. And so we lose those. Our culture loses the power of that. I just did a memorial service for a man and his brother. There were a lot of people from his work. No one at his work had been told that he had AIDS or that he was dying. So they were all deprived of getting to visit him. And they came in a huge number to this memorial service because he had been a very beloved person at his work, which his family didn't know, and the people at work didn't know his family, and that's the way it often is with AIDS. But anyway, his brother, they in the service, we made a time of sharing, and his brother shared this experience that the day after his brother died, he was in his brother's apartment starting the sorting process, and he walked in the living room and he saw his brother sitting there. And his brother had been paralyzed for a month before he died and hadn't been able to speak. And he said, and he was in a coma at the end. And he walked in and his brother was sitting there and he said, "Jerry, your eyes are open." And his brother said, "Yes, and I can talk too." And the phone rang and that was the end of it. Now, I'm just telling you that because I've heard hundreds of stories like that. But people don't tell them, because they don't have a place to tell them. I had a Presbyterian team in Little Rock that when their person got really ill, they had to take him out of his apartment, his final move, because he couldn't stay by himself anymore. And so they brought a truck and they were loading all of his things. And the very last thing to move was him. He was gonna move to a friend's house. And he was on the couch and three men wrapped him up in a comforter and carried him down the stairs and around the corner of a building, and they were gonna put him, and they did put him in the back seat of a car and moved him, and he died several days later. And one of those men came to me and said, "I have to tell you something. I really have to tell you something." And I said, "Well, what is it?" And he said, "You know, I'm a scientist. I do research at the university, and I don't believe in very many mysterious things, but I have to tell you what happened to me when we were carrying him. On the way around the corner of the building, we sort of slipped, and when we did that, my eyes met his, and this man was very thin, and he did and he had a beard, and he looked like he was dying, really. And he said, when our eyes met, everything stopped. It was like time stopped, and I was in a deep cave, and I looked in those eyes, and it was Jesus. And he said, I know it was Jesus. And he said, I don't believe in things like this, so I don't know what to do. And I said, why don't you go talk to your pastor? And so he went and talked to his pastor, and the pastor called me, and he said, the strangest thing, Trudy, this man came and told me this, and the same exact thing happened to me that day. And I wasn't going to tell anyone. And it had happened to both of them. So the scientist was very, he said, my life just won't be quite the same as a scientist because of this. I'm going to believe in more unseen things. And he said, I've got to do something with it. So he wrote it up, and we sent it to Guidepost, and they published his story about, oh, maybe 4 years ago. It was called The Face, but it was about that experience. Now, I want you to think about the times you've been around people who have just died, people who are dying. I want you to think about your own life and your own experiences. And about anything, and this may be just talking to someone at a funeral that touched you. I want you to take some time here and think about the most moving thing or the most touching thing that's ever happened to you in connection with a death. So it doesn't have to be spiritual, it can be spiritual. Something you heard at a memorial service. Take a couple minutes and let something come to you. Just see what comes to you. Hold that in your mind. Do you have something? Does everybody have something?
Yeah, I do.
Okay, don't share it yet.
Okay.
Because this is the part of the workshop where I want to do the experience of listening in a different way so that you can get this how you don't have to be able to answer. So here's what we're going to do. You're going to tell one other person. I'm just going to divide you up into pairs. And the person who's talking will talk, and the person who's listening will not talk at all. The person who's listening will just listen. And you can not ask questions, but you can show how you feel with your body. So you can be questioning with your eyes, and you can nod your head, and you can use body language. But I want you to get a sense of what it's like to not talk. And also I want you to get a sense of what it's like to be heard without someone commenting. So the person who's talking will finish, and then you'll just be silent until I say switch to the next person. So the other tool of pastoral care is silence, and we're all pretty much afraid of that. And so this is going to be practicing in listening and in silence both. Okay, and I want you to do this with someone you don't know, which makes it even more uncomfortable, but it makes it work really well. Mark, we're going to do the listening exercise the way we did it before when you were in my group, with the person who's talking talks and the person who's listening doesn't say anything.
Yeah.
You remember?
Okay.
So, the two of you can maybe go back in the corner there.
This is it. The time of a death.
This is something related to death that's been very meaningful to you. And in enough detail so the other person understands why it's very meaningful. If you're not ready, we'll give you a little more time.
Oh, did I supposed to write it down?
No, just think about it. Have you had time to think about it?
Yeah.
You know what you want to share? Yeah. Could you and Don?
Yeah.
Do you know each other?
I know Don.
I know we know each other.
Very well?
Yeah.
Why don't you share with her? Go back in that corner there.